tonight on Unsolved Mysteries.
Dr. Michael Swango's career began with great promise, only to be derailed by allegations of poisoning and murder. What happened to Michael Swango? Did an angel of mercy choose to become an angel of death? Some 30 years have passed since a young woman from Texas and a Jordanian airman fell in love, only to be torn apart by the uncertainties of war. Now a heartbroken father needs your help to find the son he has never met. Little Logan Carroll was born with no heartbeat and no vital signs. Doctors could do nothing to save him. But as Logan's family gathered to grieve, something truly extraordinary happened. Something that can only be called a miracle.
Join me. Perhaps you hold the key. Perhaps you may be able to solve one of tonight's unsolved mysteries.
February 7th, 1984, Columbus, Ohio. An intern at the State University Hospital checked on a 69-year-old woman recovering from routine back surgery. No one knows why Dr. Michael Swango was in the room, perhaps just to say hello. When he left, Rena Cooper seemed to be doing fine. As she was being stabilized, Rena struggled to tell the doctors what happened.
I'll let you write a note to us, okay?
She wrote, "The doctor put something in my IV."
That was Dr. Swango. When I was over there, I was taking some notes.
What was Dr. Swango doing?
While this is going on, we know that another nurse decided to walk down the hall to calm the other patients since there was a great deal of commotion. And four rooms down within minutes sees Dr. Swango exiting another room with a very funny grin on his face, and those are her words, not mine. The nurse goes into that room and finds a large hypodermic needle with the plunger down sitting on the sink, which is not very unusual. You wouldn't expect that in a hospital. Hypodermics aren't left lying around.
Oh, Mike, good, glad you're here. I need to talk to you for a second.
Three different doctors confronted Michael Swango about what had happened in Rena Cooper's room. Swango allegedly told three different stories. At one point, he claimed he had never even been in the room.
She just got out of surgery. It's common for patients just out of surgery to be delusional.
Most of us tend to hold doctors to a higher standard, and perhaps that's fair. After all, we are sometimes compelled to trust them implicitly, depending on their knowledge and expertise to save our lives. Did Michael Swango betray that trust for his own sadistic pleasure? If you ask Swango, he'd probably tell you he was a victim of bad luck and circumstance. But unfortunately, the question cannot be posed. No one can find Michael Swango.
Michael Swango came to Ohio as a recent graduate of the medical school at Southern Illinois University. He projected charm and confidence despite a lackluster med school record.
Michael Swango became more and more withdrawn as he proceeded through his college classes and eventually got into medical school. And though academically he did very well, the more the classes became advanced and the more he needed to do hands-on patient work, the more he pulled away from that to the point where he was held back a year.
Take a look at one of these appraisals and you can see what I'm talking about.
Swango's poor performance continued through the first 6 months of his internship.
Dr. Swango, the end result is, unless you have a significant improvement, you will not be allowed to take the next step.
Are you saying you may not recommend me for residency? I've been working my entire life to be a doctor.
Swango's lifelong goal was now jeopardized. It could mean he would never become a full-fledged doctor. It was shortly after Swango was put on probation that Rena Cooper suffered her mysterious seizure. It was one of a series of puzzling events at the hospital that spring. Rena Cooper survived, but at least five other patients died.
The five mysterious respiratory arrests in the last month in the neurosurgery wing has caused quite an alarm among all of us. I'm aware of that. I've decided to see if there's some sort of pattern to this situation, and I've developed a chart.
The upshot of it is that whenever these incidents occurred, Swango is always there. A black cloud seems to follow Michael Swango. Wherever Swango was, there was an unexplained respiratory arrest, and it didn't happen once or twice. It happened five, six, seven times.
Though some evidence appeared to point to Swango, hospital officials chose not to call the police. They decided to watch him closely and quietly wait out the last months of his internship.
I think the kid was great. I think I was better, but I think the kid was great.
Chicken! Food, thank you.
Thank you great. So much.
Swango did not appear disturbed by the hospital's decision to let him go or the whispered allegations against him. In fact, on several occasions during the last months of his internship, he treated staff members to what he called extra spicy chicken.
We know that from interviews with three doctors, they became violently ill within hours of eating the spicy chicken. So ill, in fact, that they needed treatment for their eyes from ruptured blood vessels from the vomiting.
Michael Swango left OSU Hospital in June of 1984 without being formally investigated. No charges have ever been filed. 1 month later, Swango had a new job, not as a doctor, but as a paramedic. On September 14th, he brought donuts for the whole crew.
I grabbed a donut, started eating the donut. But I noticed there was something different about the donut. It didn't spring back up like most donuts do.
You all right in there?
45 minutes later, Brent and several others became very ill. They wanted to test the leftover donuts, but they had disappeared. Only an empty box remained.
No one had any suspicions of Mike at all at that time. They figured that that was food poisoning. Since the donuts were gone and they couldn't analyze it, they just more or less thought that that's what it was and let it go by at that.
Well, the next night I worked with Mike at a football game, a local football game. At halftime, he offered to buy me a soda. I started sipping the soda at halftime, and by the start of the third quarter, I became deathly sick.
Yet another mysterious illness made Swango's co-workers increasingly suspicious. They also couldn't help noticing Swango's grisly fascination with accidents and death.
Brent!
The gorier the better.
Is she breathing?
He would describe his ultimate calls as a paramedic. And that would be a busload of children hitting head-on with a tanker truck and igniting. And as he's approaching the scene, he would see charred bodies out of the windows of the buses. Bodies that are up against the barbed wire fence, caught in the barbed wire fences. I mean, this is, to me, I thought was really strange. Just, you know, to want to see death.
No, just stay calm, man.
Finally, the paramedics decided to fake a call to get Swango out of the building. They wanted him away long enough to search his locker. In Michael Swango's gym bag, his co-workers found two bottles of ant poison. One full, one empty.
Poison.
Michael Swango?
Yes.
I am Detective Reynolds. These are officers DeWitt and Rogers. We have a warrant. Search premises. Paul, why don't you start leaving?
In Swango's apartment, police discovered more incriminating evidence. Dozens of bottles of poisons, books on poisons, recipe cards for making poisons, and an assortment of syringes. One syringe was full of ant poison. The evidence was overwhelming. Swango was convicted of 6 counts of aggravated battery and sentenced to 5 years in prison. After serving half his sentence, he was given time off for good behavior. Amazingly, Swango again found work in the healthcare field. He was apparently able to convince employers that he had been the victim of a miscarriage of justice. In Newport News, Virginia, he turned up at a medical vocational school. There, three of his colleagues reportedly fell ill. Swango then talked his way into the University of South Dakota Hospital. Again, he was shadowed by his past and dismissed. Finally, in August of 1993, Swango resurfaced to Stony Brook University in New York. He was assigned to a Veterans Administration hospital on Long Island. While there, he changed his name to Michael Kirk.
He was accepted into the Stony Brook program, and they never bothered to check him with a central registry for medical residents, which apparently had a file that was an inch thick on him. There were 180 people who applied for 12 slots, and he managed to get one of those 12 slots despite these clouds of questionable activity that followed him in at least four states.
On September 29, 1993, Michael Swango's path crossed that of Elsie and Baron Harris. Baron Harris was a 60-year-old cabinet maker from Long Island. He had a fever of 104 degrees and a slight case of pneumonia.
I'm going home tomorrow.
Well, we'll see if we can't accommodate you.
My first impressions of Dr. Kirk, he seemed very professional. He seemed to be very concerned. He seemed to know what he was doing. A very pleasant man.
Okay, if you say so.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
Yes, he will.
Okay, thank you. See you in the morning.
Yes.
Swango told Elsie to go home. There was nothing more she could do.
I'll see you in the morning, sweetheart.
Don't you forget to come back and get me.
No, you'll be all right.
I love you.
Love you too.
Elsie Harris claims that sometime during the night, Dr. Michael Swango, alias Michael Kirk, gave her husband a sedative. By the next morning, Baron had been moved to intensive care. He had lapsed into a coma.
Doesn't make any sense to me. He was coughing, he had a little fever. I don't get it, I don't understand.
Mrs. Harris, sometimes people have allergic reactions to certain drugs. Now, that may have happened in your husband's case.
But why a coma?
I just hope it wasn't anything that we did.
He had a very smirky attitude, like a half-cocked smile on his face, like a little kid with his hand in the cookie jars. This is what he reminded me of. Even though he had a terrific bedside manner, there was just something sneaky about him.
Once the story hit the wires and reporters started converging on the Northport VA hospital and on his dorm room, he very hastily packed up and disappeared.
Before Michael Swango vanished, Elsie Harris says he told her that Baron would never come out of his coma. Swango apparently knew what he was talking about. Baron Harris died on November 9th, 1993. Wherever Michael Swango is today, authorities believe that he is most likely working in the medical field.
Every parent hears of these stories that it's your worst nightmare. It's worse than that. The person that hurt Amy and took Amy has no idea what they've done. I mean, she was such an integral, vital part of life that it's very hard, very, very hard. I guess the biggest thing question anybody's mind is, why did the person choose Amy?
She had no enemies, no secret habits, no taste for danger. She was a world-class athlete who kept her mind focused and her body primed.
There was no reason for her to die. The circumstances of Amy Willard's death would lead some to conclude that the killer was well-versed in police procedure. During the investigation, three men with just such knowledge came forward to offer eyewitness accounts. Each reportedly placed himself at the crime scene, yet each told a different story. Some believe all three were merely publicity seekers. But until a suspect is actually charged with Amy's murder, their true motives will remain the subject of intense scrutiny. In 1992, George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, offered Amy a full athletic scholarship. By her junior year, Amy was ranked among the top 25 female lacrosse players in the United States.
She had a talent, and she loved it. Amy always said whether they won or lost, she had a good day. She played well, the team did well, she felt good. It didn't matter what the outcome was. Like, they didn't have to win all the time as long as everybody enjoyed what they were doing, as much as she did.
In June of 1996, Amy returned to her home in Philadelphia for the summer. She enrolled in classes at a local school. On Wednesday night, June 19th, Amy met up with friends at Smokey Joe's Tavern, a well-known college hangout. She stayed for about 3 hours.
Are you seeing anyone?
Yeah, I've gone on a couple of dates lately. But, you know, nothing serious, really.
Amy's friends say that she drank less than one beer and left the bar before they did, somewhere between 1:30 and 1:40 a.m.
Okay, see you later.
Okay,
bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
At 2:03 a.m., Amy's car was discovered by off-duty paramedics. It was parked on the shoulder of a highway transition road, engine running, headlights ablaze, car radio playing. Amy, however, was gone, and fresh blood stains on the pavement suggested that she hadn't gone willingly. Within the hour, state police would be scouring the area for clues.
They found some blood along the right side of the car on the guardrail. They found a palm print on the car. And the next morning, about 10 a.m., at the top of the ramp, they found her underwear and her tennis shoes.
With daylight, the search had expanded to include helicopters, canine teams, and legions of volunteers.
Around noon, as police were searching for Amy Willard's body, essentially, police say a guy showed up at the ramp and told them he had been on the ramp the night before and had seen a car.
You were out here last night?
Yeah, I was driving by and I saw the car.
Did you see anyone near the car?
No, I just saw the car.
They took his name and address and said they'd get back in touch with him. And in the interim, they checked him out and found out that he used to work in the area of 16th and Indiana where Amy's body was found.
Amy's unclothed body was found the afternoon of her disappearance by children playing in a vacant lot in Philadelphia. She had been dumped 20 miles from her car, 5 blocks from where the young man had once worked. There was no conclusive evidence of sexual assault. 3 momentous blows to the head had crushed Amy's skull. The investigation quickly focused on the would-be eyewitness. Initially, he willingly answered questions and cooperated with the authorities.
Police searched his car and they found handcuffs, they found a flashlight, that is the type used by police. And when they searched his house, they found some police paraphernalia and they also found a magazine that could be used to order police equipment.
Prior to the search, authorities learned that the young man had once been charged with impersonating a police officer. Without warning, he stopped cooperating. Then he lawyered up.
He says through his lawyer he didn't do it. But he also denies coming to the ramp that day, and police are steadfast, saying he did come to the ramp.
The now reluctant eyewitness remains a potential suspect, but police have been unable to find any evidence that links him directly to the murder. Meanwhile, a second witness had come forward to say that he, too, was on the highway transition road the night Amy was abducted. An off-duty Pennsylvania state trooper who has since resigned claimed that not only had he seen the car, but he had spoken to a uniformed policeman sitting in a squad car parked behind it.
The police are very adamant that this trooper was elsewhere when he said he was on the ramp, but the trooper is just as adamant that he saw what he saw, and he has always stood by his story that he saw this cop car behind Amy's.
In a stunning turnaround 1 week later, newspapers reported that a local policeman did come forward to admit he had been at Amy's car.
Are they okay here?
Yeah, you already called the local PD. They're on their way.
However, the officer made no mention of the state trooper, though he did say that he had talked to the ambulance driver on the scene.
The police re-interviewed the ambulance crew, and they said that absolutely they had not talked to this officer that night. He agreed to resign from the force and cooperate fully with them, and in exchange, he would not be prosecuted for lying to them.
Well,
One alleged police impersonator and two bona fide officers.
You need any help?
Was there an ounce of truth in anything they said?
Is everything all right?
Each had reportedly thrust himself into the limelight with an eyewitness account. Each in turn was questioned as a potential suspect.
There are a lot of coincidences here. The first suspect worked in the area of where Amy's body was found. The trooper lived around the corner, very near where Amy lived with her mom. The officer used to take his drunk drivers for blood tests to the hospital where Amy's mom works. Are they coincidences or are they all linked? I mean, that's for the police to find out.
To date, authorities have not amassed enough proof to charge anyone with a crime. However, some of the evidence does suggest that whoever killed Amy Willard approached her under the guise of authority.
A woman like Amy, according to her family, would not have stopped for just anyone. It's nearly 2 a.m. in the morning. She's in a car. She's alone. So a police impersonator or a police officer seems to be the most likely reason she would have pulled over.
Take a step out of the car, please.
I don't understand what the problem is.
Listen, we've been on the road. Drinking, smiling, crying. Let me see your driver's license.
I think Amy realized she was in trouble and was going to run and took off, and that she was moving. They hit her, and Amy was gone. That's what I would like to think happened, that she only had fear for a couple seconds and that she didn't know anything else that happened to her. We loved Amy. We loved her more than anything in this world. And we are thankful to God for giving her to us. And the way that he chose to end her life, that's something that we try to deal with, but we're not going to dwell on. Our job is making sure that Amy is remembered for the wonderful person that she was, instead of the way that her life was ended. That's for the police to handle.
Amy Willard was last seen alive at Smokey Joe's Tavern in Wayne, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia, on June 20th, 1996, around 1:30 a.m. Amy's car was found here, on the transition road leading from Interstate 476 to Route 1. Amy Willard's body was discovered in this vacant lot at 16th and Indiana in North Philadelphia. In a moment, the tragic death of an infant is followed by a miraculous rebirth. Perhaps the only time we welcome a visit to the hospital is for the birth of a child. But even this special moment can be marred by sudden disaster. Just ask an Indiana couple named Todd and Tammy Carroll. Their second child, Megan, was stillborn after an 8-month pregnancy. Naturally, Megan was very much on their minds when the Carrolls arrived at the hospital for the birth of their third child, a son named Logan. They had no idea how close they would come to another tragedy.
Hi, Dr. O'Connor.
Hi, Tammy.
Oh, this is my sister, Ruthie. She's going to be with us today.
Hi, Ruthie. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Well, Tammy, everything looks great.
After we lost Megan, I was real anxious. It was real stressful. I was worried, is anything going to be wrong with this baby? Is, you know, everything going to be all right? And after the ultrasound, and everything looked good on it, and then we ran some other tests that looked fine, that eased my mind. I really tried to look at it as a separate incident.
Okay, here comes the next one.
Tammy's obstetrician, Dr. Diana Oken, induced labor at around 8:45 a.m. The contractions grew stronger and more frequent through the day. The baby's vital signs were consistently stable and positive.
Okay, not long of a rest.
4:30 p.m. Birth was imminent. Tammy's sister, Ruthie, stationed herself near the fetal heartbeat monitor. The red numbers showed a normal rate, 120 to 140 beats per minute.
Another deep breath and push.
Well, while Tammy was pushing, trying to push the baby out, I noticed that the heart monitor would drop way down, and that really kind of alarmed me, and they had her take some slow breaths, and it recovered back up.
One more push, deep breath and push.
4:42 p.m. At the moment Logan Carroll was born, his heart rate plunged to zero, a fragile life in mortal danger.
I knew something was wrong as soon as he delivered because he didn't have any tone. When I felt his umbilical cord, I didn't feel any pulse at all. And that's when we started CPR.
Why isn't he crying? Why isn't he crying?
Relax, it's all right.
What's wrong with me, man?
Quiet.
Call a code.
For 15 minutes, the emergency team tried desperately to revive Logan. At 4:57, Dr. Mary Valentine, the Carroll's pediatrician, joined the emergency team.
What's the history here?
An eventful pregnancy. We lost the heart rate immediately before delivery.
Logan still had no vital signs, no heartbeat, no breathing.
No heart rate, flatline.
Stop compression.
No heart rate, flatline.
Continue resuscitation.
We continued doing CPR throughout that time, again with no response for approximately another 15 minutes after my arrival. And I began inserting a line into his umbilical cord to try to administer some drugs to help revive him. They had put EKG monitor on him, and the tracing was not showing any electrical activity, so I knew it didn't look good at all.
Time, why?
Well, I was still hoping, but he was there so long. I don't know how many, five or six doctors there working on him at one time trying to get him revived, and it still ain't doing nothing.
I just couldn't lose this baby. I just could not believe this could happen again.
At some point, you know, you always have to just say, we've done what we can do. This baby is not going to respond. And we finally called it and pronounced him dead at that time.
I'm sorry.
No! I don't think there's any lower feeling than holding your dead child. It's supposed to be such a time of joy and renewed life giving birth, that when they hand you this child that's no longer living, I just can't begin to tell you how low that feeling is. And sitting there holding him and looking in his face, I just wanted him to be alive so bad.
Logan James Carroll was officially pronounced dead at 5:15 p.m. He was 33 minutes old. In accordance with hospital policy, the Carrolls were allowed time to say their goodbyes. Swaddled in a blanket, Logan was cradled by each grieving family member. In the midst of their anguish, Tammy and Todd agreed to an autopsy, hoping for some explanation.
Tammy, Todd, I don't mean to sound crass or anything, but we usually take pictures of the baby for the family.
You never know how people are going to take that when you come in and say, I'd like to take pictures of you and the baby. But they were very receptive because they said they didn't get enough pictures the last time that this had happened to them.
These photos were taken that afternoon, stark portraits meant to commemorate the end of a young life. Instead, It would mark the beginning of a miracle.
What was that?
What was what?
He just made a noise.
That was just a reflex action, Tammy.
Are you sure?
I'm sorry.
While I was holding Logan, he made the gasping sound. And it was a very eerie feeling, but we had been told that that was normal.
It is called agonal gasping, and it can happen because of the medication. It can go on for quite a while. So I wanted to let them know, because every time he would do that, he did it a couple times for Tammy, they would just, their eyes would light up, and then they would be really let down when he wouldn't do it again.
As the minutes went by, I was slowly becoming unaware of what even was going on in the room. I just wanted to completely detach myself and float away somewhere and be somewhere where it wasn't hurting so bad. I wanted to get away from the pain.
Some 40 minutes had passed since Logan was pronounced dead. The time for his autopsy was close at hand. However, as Tammy's stepmother held the infant, she was beginning to think that an autopsy would not be such a good idea.
His color looks so good.
Ruthie, he's getting warmer. Feel. Feel it. I'll get the nurse.
I'll be right back.
What's going on, Ruthie?
There's no reason for this to have happened.
Dr. O'Conn, I understand about agonal breathing, but is there such a thing as an agonal heart rate?
Susan.
He has a heart rate. Please come and take a look at him.
I thought she was nuts.
You know, if you keep this up, you're going to give me a heart attack.
I think I was afraid that she was reacting in a way that was going to upset the family even more because, I mean, the baby was dead.
He's alive. Let's get him to the nursery.
What? It was total unbelief, and I wanted to touch him. I had an uncontrollable urge. I needed to touch him. And I don't know how soon it was, but it was real soon. They came and took my IV out, and I had monitors on me, and I had a blood pressure cuff. I mean, they were taking wires and just pulling them off of me and put me in a wheelchair and wheeled me into the nursery. And I reached in, and I held his arm. And I was talking to him, telling him that he had to hang in there, and that I loved him, and that I was proud of him for being so strong. I was still in a different type of shock because it was so unbelievable.
Unbelievable indeed. At least 6 physicians and 8 registered nurses, all certain that Logan Carroll had died. High-tech meters and monitors had confirmed that judgment.
I figured God's hand had to have been in it, but that's not in the medical literature to account for the miraculous as an explanation. But it's amazing. I mean, we're all trained to do something as doctors, and here we did nothing, and he came back.
Word spread through the hospital very quickly. You know, people from the lab, people from other nursing units came up just to look at him, to say that they could have seen this miracle baby. It was incredible. The emergency room doctor came up and was totally amazed. It was something.
Logan's metamorphosis, from the lifeless infant in this photo to the squirming marble videotaped just one day later, was simply astonishing. He would remain in the hospital for the next 5 weeks. His vital signs never faltered. Though Logan remains healthy, doctors fear he may have sustained some degree of permanent neurological damage during the time he had no oxygen. Only time will tell.
My feelings for him will stay the same. Whether he has an IQ of 180 or 50, he's here. He's alive. I've held the alternative. And holding him,
no matter how he's going to develop in the future, we try to live for today. And we'll keep him.
It is impossible for most of us to fully appreciate the Carroll family's experience. Today, Logan's extraordinary revival continues to baffle any expert who studies the case. However, those who were in the delivery room that day, when despair turned to wonder, are certain that they witnessed nothing less than a modern-day miracle. Next, a poignant tale of love denied and a son lost. About to meet a man named Fawzi Mahmood. Almost 30 years ago, a single moment changed his life forever. It was the spring of 1967 in San Antonio, Texas. The event, nothing less than love at first sight. Fawzi Mahmood was a trainee in the Jordanian Air Force. He was in the United States to learn American flying techniques. He was not interested in anything else, or so he thought.
Fawzi, how are you doing? Do you remember Barbara?
Hi.
And Zoila.
Hi.
Hello.
Her name was Zoila Maldonado. She was just 20 years old. In Fawzi's eyes, she was dazzling.
What?
I mean, she looked so beautiful to me, and she got this green dress, and just she was a knockout, and I was knocked out. I fell in love with her. I mean, I fell madly in love with her.
This is beautiful.
It's pretty. I like it.
Like you. Very beautiful.
For both Fawzi and Zoila, this was her first taste of true love. But for Fawzi, it was also much more.
I like that.
Actually, Zoila was not only the first love, it was the first woman I ever talked to in my life. Because we came from a very, very strict family and strict people and a strict government, you know. But she was my first everything.
He's waiting.
Zoila's parents were very conservative, and she was their only child. They did not like the idea of Zoila dating anyone. The fact that Fawzi was a foreigner who spoke little English did not help.
He's a nice boy, Mom. What does it matter, Papa?
I guess you're going
out. Even though her parents were conservative and strict, we managed to go out almost daily. We went dancing, we went to the lake, we went to the mountains, we went everywhere together.
6 months later, Zoila and Fawzi found themselves at a turning point.
Fawzi, I think I'm pregnant.
To Zoila's great relief, Fawzi was ecstatic.
You are?
Yes. I want to marry you.
But the marriage would never take place. Several months earlier, the Six-Day War had erupted between Jordan and Israel. Tension between the two countries remained high. In late November 1967, Fawzi was ordered home.
I will come back, I promise.
Fawzi,
We talked and we promised and we vowed that we would always be together, no matter what happens.
When I come back,
I can't raise baby by myself. I can't.
You and baby come to Jordan.
I just felt so helpless.
I come back very soon.
Come on, kids, we need to get going.
I felt why love should be like that. I mean, we're having so good time together. We're happy. Why the happiness have to go?
Sometimes I miss you so much, I think I'll go crazy, but then I receive your letters and I feel better.
Zoila and Fawzi continued their love affair by letter. The Jordanian Air Force refused to release Fawzi, so Zoila planned to go to Jordan.
Please take care of yourself and stay safe. I will close now. I'm tired, but the baby's fine. It still kicks all the time. If he's a boy, he'll probably be a football player.
In late June 1968, Zoila gave birth to a healthy baby boy. She named him Amadeo Marcello.
I mean, I was thrilled. I was very happy. I was jumping. But I also was very unpleased because of the fact that I cannot be there to see him and be with her and be of help to her. I was very frustrated.
Even on duty, Fauzi's thoughts were with Zoila and his infant son. He could not wait to bring his new family to Jordan. Zoila kept writing to Fauzi, but the tone of her letters soon changed.
Fauzi, I'm writing to say I'm sorry to hear of your problem. I want us together more than ever. I will always believe my love is strong. But the war, I refuse to take that chance with Marcello's life.
Zoila made a difficult decision. She needed a father for her baby. She wrote Fauzi that she had married someone else. Fauzi could not bring himself to write to Zoila again, but he could never forget his son. In 1970, Fauzi returned to the United States. He claims he tried to call Zoila by phone, but her mother hung up on him, then had the number changed. She apparently blamed Fauzi for her daughter's out-of-wedlock child and was understandably upset to hear from him again. In desperation, Fauzi went to Zoila's house.
Hello. I'd like to see Zoila, please.
Nobody wants to talk to you.
My son. I'd like to see my son.
You ruined my daughter's life.
No, no. I love your daughter.
You know what? You are 3 years too late. If you don't get out of here, I'm going to call the police.
No, please, wait. I just want to see my son. Please, wait.
Fauzi had no choice. He could not risk being arrested and possibly deported. That moment was as close as Fauzi Mahmoud has ever gotten to meeting his son. Today, Fauzi lives in Enid, Oklahoma with his wife, Robin. They have a young son, and Fauzi has 3 grown children from a previous marriage, but thoughts of his firstborn still haunt him.
There is one thing missing all the time. I would like to see my son. I would like to see how he looks like. I want to hug him. I want to tell him I love him. I mean, there's a lot of things we did not do together. Maybe we can do it now, even at this age.
Join me again next week. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.